So as we speak, Devin, the border is being rushed by more than 100 migrants who are just knocking down some guards there, including the Texas border, I guess that's what I hear. Texas border guard. This is according to the New York Post. Doesn't look good. You could say it's only 100. I mean, I remember the day where 100 was a lot of people. Now that's literally a drop in the bucket. Compared to what the 10,000 a day that are coming in, so another 100, it's a blip.
Yeah,
it's like when you see 100, points in the Dow, it's 0.1% of the Dow. So, I don't know. It's very troubling. Maybe this is the game plan that the Democrats. You wonder how they're going to win.
Yeah,
and maybe that's it. More of a surge, the surge worked, what they call the surge in Iraq, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they need. They need a surge from the Mexican government, at least from the Mexican border.
Yeah.
It's bad news. And they are just trying to just score a lot of points. And then they're soon going to say, the migrants should be able to vote. You'll see. If you think that is preposterous, the idea of allowing migrants who are not citizens, who came here illegally, no less, would have the right to vote. And you think that's preposterous, as you should.
Yeah.
Just remember that it wasn't that long ago that they thought it was preposterous, the idea of being able to vote without a license.
Right.
And here we are right now. Now, if you ask for a license, I don't know, maybe they can arrest you. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's considered, crazy. And now the default is that you can vote without a license. Just say that you are who you are, you claim to be, and you're good to go.
Right.
Because, getting a license is very difficult for most people.
Yeah.
Thank God, the Democrats found this out and liberated us from the shackles of the driver's license. But I digress.
Yeah.
Bad things are happening for the Democrat Party. That's the way it is. They've got massive Biden problems, and it looks like they're stuck with him. Now that Trump and Biden are the presumptive nominees of their respective parties, and there's no real third party to worry about, I don't know how Biden pulls it out. On the other hand, in 2020, I thought, same thing, but then we had COVID, and, that created a big wrinkle. And I guess people didn't like Trump, but I know that there was some monkey business going on there, and they changed the laws and everything else. I'm not at all sanguine about the idea that the 2020 was a legitimate election. I'm not. There are too many bizarre anomalies, something like 19 of them all happening at the same time. It was weird.
Yeah.
It was truly weird. And for them to say it was okay, Barack, I'm sure what they should have said is, look, I'm sure there's always some degree of fraudulent balloting in any election.
Right.
But I don't we have no reason to think it's more or less.
Yeah. Okay?
But instead they said, no, it was the most perfect, cleanest election in history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. All right. Yeah. So people are really leaving the Democrat Party, and they're mocking the Democrat Party. We have, just for example, you have this from Bill Maher, who's no big Trump supporter, obviously, right?
Right.
But listen what he has to say.
Democrats are down 20 points from 3 years ago with party affiliation among African Americans. Mm-hmm. 20 points in 3 years among the group that they rely on to win elections. When is that going to dawn on them? If you're in a hole, stop digging.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well, yeah, exactly right. So that's one thing it said. And then
his administration, his next one, schools will teach students to love their country, not to hate their country like they're taught now. I got to say, this one doesn't bother me so much. Because I think that, this is what I see when I see kids demonstrating, these progressives demonstrating for Hamas, the most illiberal people in the world, that, oh, good, we're going to give America its comeuppance, asshole America. They kind of have been indoctrinated this way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And by the way, that was from, Will Fly, his YouTube channel. So it was a good compilation of what Bill Maher has said. And I think if Bill Maher is saying this, then a lot of people, reasonable Democrats, I'm not saying every Democrat is reasonable, far from it, but there are many reasonable Democrats who must be scratching their heads and just are so embarrassed by what Biden is doing. But forget about his dementia, which it's a real thing. But the border crisis that we just talked about, that the crime, the homelessness, the indoctrination of the kids, the hatred of America in particular, I think the Bill Maher is tapping into what a lot of Democrats are thinking. So it's a good sign for us. I do think that Trump is in a very good position to win. Look, and they're putting out all the stops to make sure that he can't even run, or at least to financially cripple him with the bond that's going on. I want to talk about a little bit about that for a second, and then we'll move on to some other many of the topics that we have today. So in New York, Letitia James, she's now pursuing the collection on the judgment. So here's the problem. I was on Newsmax about this, and my colleague brought this up, and I think he's right. Normally speaking, you know, a bond is a bond. It's the amount of the judgment plus 10 or 20% sometimes. So you get a $100,000 judgment, you post a bond for $120,000. That's to cover costs and expected fees and such, because you're assumed to be on the winning side of that. You know, you got the judgment, you want to respect that judgment. It's not the cost to actually have the appeal. It's not.
Right.
Okay. It's, you can still appeal any judgment. It's just that they can collect on you in the meantime.
Right.
But if you post a bond, then you're basically forestalling or making it impossible for them to collect. They are not allowed to collect because you are assured that there is money right there to collect if and when you prevail on your appeal and the underlying judgment is affirmed, not reversed, but affirmed.
Right.
Then you've got the money. You've got nothing to complain about. There's no reason for you to chase this money.
Right.
But they've made it impossible for Trump to do this. First of all, Engoron, the judge, made the judgment. I mean, he was the one who decided the number. He made it such an impossibly high number, way beyond the money that Letitia James was asking for.
Yeah.
Putting aside that there's no legal authority for this claim, putting aside that there's a statute of limitations issue, there's so many problems with it. So Engoron wanted to make it an impossibly high amount, knowing that 120% of that would make it impossible for him to financially find a bond. So here we are. And what the Trump team could do and should do, and I think will do, is to say, look, give us more time. This is a huge amount of money. It's not right for this. You can tack on more interest if you like, pending my getting the bond, but you don't have to have a hard-on, as it were, forgive my French here, to go after Trump. If you want to get the money for the state of New York, well, then you should be satisfied with a bond. But obviously, that's not your angle. Your angle is to destroy Trump, make it impossible for him to be financially viable.
Right.
That's where we're going with this. So he can still pursue his appeal. He will, the appeal will prevail. And the problem for Letitia James, and I pointed this out on the news segment, is that supposing Letitia James liquidates this or that property, she's got a big problem, because if it's reversed, he gets to get that money back.
Right.
And he gets to go after her for wrongfully liquidating the properties.
Yeah.
And he can go after the state of New York. That's a big problem. But do you think that Letitia James cares of that?
Yeah.
The answer is no.
Yeah.
Of course not. And the reason why is that her mission is to destroy Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, she said so in her campaign, and she, you know, promise made, promise delivered, you know, so to speak, right? So, Trump will come out of this. He'll get the money one way or the other. But it's insane for them to think that this will not backfire on them. This will. It'll be very bad. It'll be very embarrassing.
Yeah, and just that image that if she actually takes the building, or if she actually takes a property, which I'm sure there's a lot of problems with it, that just, all she's doing is she's buying more votes for Trump.
Yeah.
And she's making it very clear that rogue prosecutors who want to like take part and influence a national election. Rogue judges who want to just think on their own, they can just take out a presidential candidate, the winning presidential candidate. They have to be reined in. There has to be laws to say you cannot do that on either side. And until they have that, you're going to have Erdogan's going around each way just trying to, I can put in prison a presidential candidate while America simultaneously puts down Putin for putting down a presidential candidate who had no chance of winning. So it really is just votes for Trump that's coming through. And the more they make him into a martyr and the more dignity he shows every time he doesn't crack, he shows composure. He shows that he, even in the face of odds of that are completely against him, that he can still keep his head up high and be honorable. I keep on getting more and more in love with Trump from these things.
I completely respect him. The only thing that they're doing, the Democrats, is just making him more of a martyr, more of somebody that we really truly respect in the line of fire. And this battle, I wouldn't even say it's a baptism of fire for him because he's gone through a lot worse, I'm sure, in the past. But this man is a real leader. He doesn't change his tune. He doesn't try to be more soft. He doesn't try to appease anybody. He is a man.
Yeah.
This is a real man. This is a real leader. And damn it, this is the man I want for my president. Yeah. Because if he fights this hard in the face of this kind of resistance, well, by golly, when he has the American government behind him, he'll be able to fight pretty damn hard against the likes of China, who are far easier to fight, in my opinion, than the effing Democrats.
Yes.
Who are trying to destroy him from within. We have that ability when he's not the president for the time being.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. The whole thing is disgusting. I hate it. Now they're going after Trump on this. There's a couple of things. There's so many things. One is, have you heard about this bloodbath comment?
Yeah.
Okay. So
because they've never used that word.
Yes, before. Yes, exactly right. So he goes on a rally and he makes this speech. So let's take a listen.
Big monster car manufacturing plants that you're building in Mexico right now. And you think you're going to get that. You're going to not hire Americans.
He's
and you're going
China.
To sell the cars to us. Now, we're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those guys. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
So that statement made shockwaves throughout the world. They interpret it as they always do. They want to say that he's promising a bloodbath of people, you know, that are going to be dying in the streets, and you know, he's going to encourage his minions, his crazy hick minions, you know, a Christian-loving Christian, you know, minions, to go kill anybody that is disagrees with Trump because, you know, that's we're like zombies.
Yeah.
You know, like the Borg from Star Trek, you know.
Because that's what Trump's always done.
Yeah, he's always done that. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And you and I are foot soldiers for Trump, and we will just tell us who to kill, and we'll create a bloodbath.
We've done it before.
We'll do it again. No, of course. I mean, this is madness, right? Yeah. So they take that and they say, look, he's promising a bloodbath. Of course, the topic is about Detroit and how it's going to be terrible for the car manufacturers. And they're going to suffer that way. That's the whole point of it. But they want to portray it the way they want to portray it.
Yeah.
This is the kind of crap that you expect. And I don't blame them because they have nothing else. They have zero else. Okay? Now, let's continue on with this particular speech because I think he says something that's very meaningful, which is that elections may not be quite what we want them to be if we cannot win this easily winnable election.
Yeah.
Let's play this.
If this election isn't won, I'm not sure that you'll ever have another election in this country. Does that make sense? I don't think you're going to have another election in this country. If we don't win this election, I don't think you're going to have another election, or certainly not an election that's meaningful. And we better get out, or we better. I actually say that the date, remember this, November 5th, I believe it's going to be the most important date in the history of our country.
You know what? He might be right.
Yeah.
He might be right. By the way, there's a guy that you can't see the video here. There's a guy who's just nodding along with it. He's awesome. He's got a tie on. He's nodding very vigorously in support of what Trump is saying. It's very sweet. But boy, he's spot on. This election is very, very important. And November 5th, yeah, I think, let's play it out. If Biden were to win, the Democrats were to win with whoever they present, then the border is just wide open at that point. Then, crime and everything. They're on that cusp of completely destroying America. It's the end. Yeah. And then the elections that we do have are going to be kangaroo elections,
right?
Like Russia has right now. 98% voting for the Democrats. Oh, I guess the country really loved the Democrats. And the talking heads will say, well, America really is a very progressive country now. We are really shaping up. And you and I will be stomping our feet. Well, wait a minute. And then we'll be arrested. And, it's all good. That's the way they look at it. Anybody that disagrees with them is asking for an insurrection of the country.
Yeah.
That's the way they'll parlay it. I think that's the way they're going to parlay it. 100%, so it's very disturbing. So yes, I think November 5th, 2024 is going to be a moment in time that will be so critical. They want it to be January 6th, 2021.
Yeah.
That has turned out to be a farce, at least the characterization, that insurrection. I don't think people really believe it. Look, I've always said before, Devin, that if you treat the Democrat Party as a person, and then you begin to hear all the lies that this person has made, the false presentations, the idea of the Hunter Biden laptop, the Russian collusion thing, and all the other lies that they've made. There's been so many. At some point, you say, well, if they lied to me about that, why aren't they lying to me about other things?
Right.
So it's very fair. I think that's happening. That's what Bill Maher, as we just played, seems to be pointing out. And it's a very concerning time.
Yeah.
Okay, so they have yet another attack on Trump. Now, this time, it's about the Jews, right? They're claiming that Trump is saying that the Jews are not real Jews if they don't vote for him, right?
Okay. Because Biden would never.
Yeah. Biden would never say anything like that. Let's say about the blacks. No. What is it? You ain't black if you don't vote for me, right? Come on, man. If you don't vote for me, then you're not black. You ain't black. Yeah, you ain't black. In particular,
all the time.
That's the way. That's the way he talks all the time.
Yeah.
All right. So listen to what he actually says with Sebastian Gorka, who's of course very friendly to him. Used to work with Trump. Here you go.
Why do the Democrats hate Bibi Netanyahu?
I actually think they hate Israel.
Those remarks drew sharp criticism, including from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
So just to let you know, so he doesn't say anything about the Jews here, right? The Democrats hate Israel. Yeah. I think that's true. Okay, and I'm Jewish. You're Jewish.
Yeah.
And they just don't like Israel.
No.
Well, you can't. You're fighting against Israel all the time. You're trying to cripple her all the time. And they don't like Israel. Come on, let's face it.
Yeah.
I mean, at the very least, you can say of those people who do hate Israel, they're all Democrats.
Right.
99% of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's continue on. So they're talking about Chuck Schumer now, right? And their response to it.
Former president's comments were utterly disgusting and a textbook example of the kind of anti-Semitism facing Jews, pushing the dangerous anti-Semitism trope of dual loyalty.
Where in that statement was there an accusation of dual loyalty? Where?
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist. So look, they have to fabricate these things. They just like you saw about the bloodbath comment, they have to totally fabricate it because it's all going to be about scaring now. Yeah. Now it's about the next Hitler. The problem for them, of course, is that, newsflash, Trump was already president. Yeah. I mean, they would have a much better platform to make this argument had Trump never been president. Then they could portray him as some sort of Caesar, at best, and a Hitler at worst. But no, I mean, he was president. He didn't do any of those things. On the contrary, he delivered a fantastic country. Abraham Accords and everything else. He's the most pro-Jew. Do we really need to say this? Abraham Accords, You know, Netanyahu loved him. Moving the capital. Israelis love him.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and he's got a Jewish daughter.
Yeah.
Orthodox children, and somehow he's anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Got it.
Yeah.
Right. He wears a yarmulke to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem while he's president. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. They really are reaching, and it's look. I mean, the funny thing is, we're only 2.4% of the American population. So you would think, like, okay, well, nobody seems to give a rat's ass about the Jews among the other minorities in this country, right? You ask, suddenly he's protective of the Jews, really? But the Democrats seem to hate the Jews. There's an incredible rise in anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
I'm not saying all Democrats are anti-Semitic, of course, but some of them are Jewish themselves.
Yeah.
But the point is, the anti-Semitism is all coming from the left.
Right.
And then he's defending. Just pick a lane. That's all I ask. All right. Anyway, there's more to talk about this, but the media has pounced on this, and now they're saying that that Trump is doubling down on this. They confronted him outside of Mar-a-Lago, and he gives a very good response. In addition to saying that he doesn't give a crap about Michael Pence supporting him or not, like I couldn't care less, he said. And good for him. That was a great response. But in addition to that, he defends his remarks about the Jewish voters.
Defending his remarks about Jewish voters.
I think that the Democrats have been very, very opposed to Jewish people. That's true. And to Israel. All you have to do is look at Senator Schumer. What he did with Israel is a disgrace.
Trump doubling down on the latest controversy around his rhetoric.
What rhetoric? Okay, what is that?
Yeah.
That's insane. There's nothing rhetorical about this. It's not, there's no sort of anger about this. It's right. The Democrats don't like Israel.
Right.
And how they twisted that to be that Jewish voters don't love Israel or anything like that. Look, there's a separate comment that he made about Jewish voters. That's true. But it wasn't that. It wasn't that Jews hate Israel.
Yeah.
He's basically saying that those who love Israel vote Republican.
Right.
And those who don't vote Democrat.
Right.
That's the way it is.
Yeah. And one thing I think is a good way to show it is because they'll disagree on the facts, but like the underlying value. Can we at least we agree? Okay, so anti-Semitism is wrong. Anybody who is marching in favor of October 7th should be deported immediately and have to live in Palestine. How about that? Can't we all agree on that since anti-Semitism is wrong? Can't like we both agree on that because you're accusing him of something. Maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. I don't think Trump is, but why don't we just say, okay, so any anti-Semite will never be able to get citizenship in America, and maybe we should deport them all if they are.
Devin Goodman, you are an interesting fellow.
Yeah.
Look, if you're anti-Semitic, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. If you're anti-American, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
You have the right to stay in the country, but I don't know why you would.
Right.
If you hate this country so much, okay, maybe consider moving to another country. You always threaten it.
Yeah.
You know, if Trump wins, I will move. And that wasn't just Trump. It was Bush also.
Yeah.
Bush Jr. and it was Bush Sr. And Romney, for that matter. As milquetoast as Romney was, people said that this will be the end of the country somehow. Really? Yeah. Really?
He's a Democrat.
He somehow survived all this time. And,
yeah.
But now they're really going to do it. Where are you going to go to?
What
greater country is there?
Right.
Right? I mean, maybe you should go to Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wait. That's the country you say is an apartheid country and a genocidal country.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think, you know, of course, Israel is an amazing country. It's
right.
It's even far better in many ways than America is in terms of its openness and in terms of its innovation and in terms of its values.
Right.
But okay. So don't go to Israel either. Where are you going to go? You want to go to Jordan? Okay. Be my guest.
Right.
Good luck. Being anything other than a certain kind of Muslim, let alone Muslim.
Yeah.
And then maybe Singapore. Okay, go there.
Yeah.
You'll live under a benevolent dictatorship, not a good one.
Yeah.
Go to Canada. Okay, great. You know, good luck ever innovating anything, living under socialism, having high taxes and such like that, but and not being free to speak your mind unless it's a liberal mind, of course.
Right.
Maybe Canada's good for you. Maybe Venezuela's good for you. I just get out.
Yeah.
You hate it so much. Get out. I don't know what to say. People are leaving Los Angeles and California.
Yeah.
They don't like it. They're getting out. Why can't, if you don't like the whole country, then get the frig out.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not demanding you to, but I don't see why you stay here.
Right.
I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Clearly, there are better countries than America. Go.
Yeah.
Just have fun.
Yeah.
Maybe Italy's your answer. I don't know.
South Africa.
Yeah. Cuba.
Yeah.
Canada. Cuba has very nice weather.
Yeah.
Very nice weather.
Yeah, mojitos.
Yeah. Mojito. I don't know what they eat in Cuba. Anyway, so they doubled down on the Jewish voter issue. So here is MSNBC about the rhetoric
to the Trump comments.
Yeah. That's right, Andrea. The condemnation of those comments started to roll in pretty quickly after that podcast was first posted online yesterday, and news organizations began to take notice of it. Chuck Schumer, who you're referring to, of course, the majority leader and the highest ranking elected Jewish American in history, was very quick to condemn it. He said,
Wait. Look how they're so hot to trot about him being, Chuck Schumer, being the highest ranking Jewish leader. And that gives him the bona fides, right? Well, can you imagine if we had said, oh, look, and he's black and he's supporting Trump.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, what he says goes. Okay. Therefore, he's right.
Right.
Right. The Democrats would be on us like white on rice.
Right.
That sounds like a racist phrase all of a sudden. White on rice. I mean, somehow they'll make it a racist phrase.
White
but anyway,
on white, bread.
White on white bread. Oh, my God, that's even worse. All right. Here we go. Let's continue on.
That the comments are part of a hateful rant by Donald Trump. And it's not just Democrats. The head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, talked about the idea that these comments, he said, are defamatory and patently false, and suggested that serious leaders who care about the U.S.-Israel alliance should not be making them. Now, looking back at Donald Trump over his political history, he has spoken in this manner many times, suggesting kind of leaning into the dual loyalty trope, anti-Semitic trope that exists about American Jews, that somehow their loyalty can't be divided or is divided between Israel and the United States. But this.
Okay, but where did he say anything about dual loyalty?
Yeah.
Where did Trump accuse Jews of having dual loyalty? Where was that from?
Yeah.
That's weird, because nowhere did Trump say that.
Yeah.
It is the weird. So they just take the ball and they snowball it as much as they can to make it morph into something that it's nowhere close to. Just zero. Zero connection to the reality of what he actually said. But again, Devin, that's all they have.
Yeah.
This is really an interesting comment about the nature of debate. When you have nothing to say, you end up attacking the other side by way of ad hominem attacks, calling them slurs of some kind or the other, or inventing things that they never said.
Yeah.
You can call it straw manning, I guess, but in this case, they just invent things completely.
Yeah.
So the bloodbath comment, the Jewish comment here.
Yeah.
And we say this is Jews. There's no way to interpret anything that he said, either in the audio clip or otherwise that I've read that says anything about dual loyalty or that Jews can't be trusted. Or why not run and say that Trump said that Jews should all be kicked out of the country.
Right.
Why not just continue on with this and then have Chuck Schumer, indignantly defending Jews, saying, we will not be forced out of this country. We don't care whether you were president once before or running as a candidate. You have no right to slaughter us and to put us in the concentration camps. I wouldn't be surprised if Schumer said something like that. And with his bona fides being Jewish himself, he's an embarrassment. I want you to know, I have a lot of conservative listeners, Chuck Schumer is an embarrassment to Jews everywhere, just like, I don't know. I'm sure a lot of blacks would be very embarrassed by Jussie Smollett, for example.
Oh, my God.
Okay,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's our Jussie Smollett.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it. All right, let's continue on because we got a lot to cover. And then I want to have a very interesting interview with Our good friend Moti Gur, who has an enormous story to tell about the Hamas situation. But let's talk a little bit about that, because the United States is apparently trying to push Israel into not really fighting anymore.
Right.
They're tired of the fighting. Don't attack in Rafah. Rafah is, like I said, the southernmost town of Israel. Yeah. And they want to, the Israelis are now routed that whole place that surrounded it, and they want to get rid of Hamas.
Right.
Okay? I want them to kill Hamas too, every single one. Kill them. If you can't kill them, then take them prisoner. But I prefer killing them.
Yeah. But like, I never heard a Democrat or a pro-war person for the Ukraine side like say, no, Ukraine, you shouldn't attack this area or that area. It would be kind of anti-Ukraine to say such things like that, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah, they have full reign to do whatever they want, the Ukrainians. Yeah. But when it comes to Israel, you got to pump the brakes. And yeah. This is what we're going to do. And they want to condition certain things. They're trying to tie aid to whether Israel will attack in Rafah. Really, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
The audacity.
That's not pro-Israel.
Now, of course it's not pro-Israel. But they want to be pro-Israel, but at the same time, they want to show that they're really being tough on Israel. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. They'll get those 100,000 uncommitted voters back in the D column soon enough. There's nothing that Biden can do. This is the problem. When you try to please everyone, you piss off everyone instead. Yeah. And that's what he's done. So it's this kind of funky dynamic that's at play right now, and they're really trying to appease both the Jewish voters on the one hand and the pro-Israel voters on the one hand, and then, of course, the anti-Israel voters on the other. This is a kerfuffle of their own making.
Yeah.
They have nobody else to blame. And here you see Kirby talking about Blinken and otherwise and how they're going to try to stop the Israelis from proceeding in Rafah. They don't quite tell them that they can't do anything, but just hear it yourself, I suppose. You can see the conundrum.
I can tell you that absent any full consideration of protecting civilians at that scale in Gaza, military operations right now would be a disaster for those people, and it's not something that we would support.
Has the U.S.
And by the way, his face looks very, very serious and very sincere. Okay. We can't support it, so just don't do it. The subliminal message, the underlying message is, Israel, don't do it. But they're going to do it.
Yeah. Communicated everything that you just said about protecting civilians to Israel?
Secretary Blinken, in his meetings with the Israeli leaders, the prime minister and the war cabinet, made clear our concerns.
Yeah, so he made clear his concern. And the Israeli war cabinet is going to say, thank you, F off.
Yeah.
Okay, there's no way that Israel is going to be listening to America on this. First of all, like the rest of the country, like even Bill Maher, he's lost respect for Biden, and the Israelis just are not going to play the game. And I think the Israelis, you know, obviously are looking at their calendar, and they're saying, how many months away is November 5? It's you know, it's 7.5 months now away.
Oh, my God. Wow.
It's not that far away.
Wow.
And they'll say, okay, you know what? We could stomach some blows here.
Yeah.
Maybe they won't give us some money, all right? Maybe they won't give us some military. But you know what? We're actually doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And we can get some support from Australia, from Canada, believe it or not.
Yeah.
There's a lot of support they can get from different countries, England too.
Right.
And they'll be just fine.
Yeah.
And they'll have a lot of American money coming in to support them. It'll be so that there's no worries that Israel will finish this job that it needs to do. And they figure there's a good chance, in fact, a very good chance that Trump will win in November.
Yeah.
And all will be quote unquote forgiven. You know, not that Trump would need to forgive them, because he would say, I was with you 100%. What more could I do to help you clean up the mess of Rafah and, for that matter, all of Gaza? And I fully support your efforts to go in there and keep peacekeepers in there to de-Hamasify all of Gaza and hopefully even the West Bank.
Yeah.
That is the opportunity. I think the Israelis see it. They look at the calendar and they're making that calculation, as they should, as they should. So shame on them for doing all this. They just can't win. They've created all these strange bedfellows. They've decided that there's no moral compass that they need to follow. There is, it's all about votes. There's the pro-Hamas vote and there's the pro-Israel vote.
Yeah.
And they want them both.
Right.
But you can't have it both ways. Yeah. Instead, you're pissing off both the pro-Israelis, like you and me, and the pro-Hamas, like the people in Michigan and elsewhere, Minnesota and otherwise, who are, you know, very pro-Palestinian. So you lose both of them. Yeah. I don't know how he's going to get out of that.
Yeah.
Other than another black swan event like COVID, right?
An unpredictable event that no one can predict, but guess what's going to happen soon, right before the election, so no one can vote and everyone has to mail in and the USPS union's completely pro-Democrat. Who would have thunk it? And no one's going to check a signature. I think I can predict a black swan.
All right, so completely different news, we will plug in that interview with Moti Guor, very interesting, Moti Guor. So there's a First Amendment ruling that is going to be coming out. There was a major hearing between the government and social media, and what has apparently come out is that the government was strongly suggesting to social media such as Facebook and Twitter not to elevate certain stories such as the Hunter Biden laptop. This is before 2020. And it turns out that they were extremely aggressive. The information is coming out. Like the government was basically saying, why aren't these posts taken down? Why aren't you doing anything yet? You know, really rushing and pushing these people. When the FBI comes knocking on your door and they ask you, we would really appreciate it if you could take this down. You really think it's the same thing as some layperson, some regular citizen asking you the same thing? Of course not. Yeah. There's the implied threat that if you don't do it, they may take some action against you for spreading disinformation. Putting aside the fact, not that it should be relevant, but I'll add it anyway,
yeah,
that these stories, the Hunter Biden laptop, for example, were true.
Yeah.
Okay, they're actually accurate, but they decided that they didn't like it, so let's suppress it. They elevate any wackadoodle story about Trump or Republicans or conservatives. Yeah. That, you know, that's a matter of free speech. We got to get it out there. No problem there. But when it's affecting them, this is the height of why the First Amendment is there in the first place.
Yeah.
This is why.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to listen to the hearings the Supreme Court, they haven't made a decision yet. You know, it's kind of a murky analysis. I don't know that they can do anything other than what I want, which is that the government cannot do indirectly what it cannot do directly.
Yeah.
And they might say, look, we need more information as to how pressuring they were as to that. The government should be able to exercise its own persuasive powers, just like a citizen can. But that only means that some citizens are more powerful than others, and we don't like that.
Right.
So we don't want that. The other thing about all this is the question of what would happen. I mean, the Supreme Court always does this, so I think they're going to do this analysis. What would happen if they did rule in favor of the government, meaning that they did nothing wrong by, you know, consulting with Facebook and Twitter and taking their approach to the whole thing and saying, well, you can't use guns to force people to change. That if that were the standard, that would be a terrible standard, but let's say that they did that.
Right.
Then what would be the consequence? It would basically give a green light to the Democrats, particularly, to just be to muscle everybody that they didn't like, including newspapers.
Yeah,
we didn't like that story. That's disinformation.
Right.
Please, you know, would you mind taking that down?
Right.
Okay. Well, so New York Times, they didn't like that, or you know, the Washington Examiner, which is a conservative paper. There would be. At some point, very quickly, there'd be very little free press.
Right.
Because the government would always be watching. I think they'll come down on the side of free speech, which is don't do it.
Yeah.
It's like the appearance of a conflict. This is appearance of pressure.
Exactly. But this is the weird thing, and where Democrats seem to always position themselves really well so they win, is what would be the relief? If we can't personally sue each FBI person personally, or they do prison time, which I would prefer, actual prison time for it, what is the relief? Is then everybody in America has to pay the relief for that, and which is absurd because then we're taxed for the bad deeds of the FBI, and the FBI doesn't have to pay for it. And that's where I think, and just to add to your point of like the New York Times, they print a paper. They distribute the paper everywhere. It's distributed. It's really hard for the FBI to stop it. But with the internet, the FBI can just remove it without it even like, or they can just, you know, hide it, or they can make it so very few people can see it. And that's where it's not as permanent as a newspaper. And it's so much more disturbing. And the fact that we have not discussed actual criminal prosecution of everybody in the FBI for doing this is really a scary point.
It's scary, and that's why November 5th, 2024, like Trump said, is going to be a very landmark day. We've got to win this.
Yeah.
And I feel like we will.
Yeah.
But the Democrats, you just don't know what they're going to come up with, and that's what scares me. I often say when I go to court, about going to court, the times that I get most nervous about going to court are the times when I know I'm going to win.
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a really good case. Because then you don't know what the other side's going to come up with. Some crazy thing that they're going to say. Something crazy. They don't just say, well, I guess I'm going to die today. They don't do that.
No.
They find a way to say crazy arguments. And then they start making accusations and terrible things. And all of a sudden, you're on your heels. And I think the Republicans are pretty good about dealing with it now. But we just really have to play. We have to be Israelis.
Yeah.
Right? We have to play all the possible war games in our heads.
Yeah.
Think like the Democrats and what they might do. And then guard against that possibility.
Yeah.
Just you have to be ready. This is war. In many ways, it's like war.
Yeah,
I don't trust anything the Democrats do. They invent crap. We know that they invent crap. It's so dastardly.
Yeah,
and I thought the Billy Bush video thing, the audio was so dastardly, and so it seems so tame now in comparison.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
And then they had to invent the Russian collusion story and prostitutes peeing on beds and what.
BLM riots.
I mean, encouraging people to go out there, saying that if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. And
yeah.
I mean, everything is weird about it. And okay, so that is a bad enough thing. Now, with the border crisis, they have the Texas ruling. The Supreme Court basically said, Texas, you can actually defend your borders. It was a temporary ruling, basically not allowing the blocking of the enforcement of Texas of its own borders, basically telling the appellate court, which is the court below the Supreme Court, you gotta be consistent with what we're saying.
Right.
And the appellate court is probably not going to have anything to do with it, and then they're going to probably try to block it again.
Yeah.
Texas will still enforce the border, and it's going to say it is a violation of state law to do this. We will deport you.
Yeah.
Mexico is saying, we're not going to accept your deportees because we're with the federal government on this. Like somehow the Mexican government is now deciding how our law should be applied. It's really right. Cute. But I don't care. Let's fly them over the border and deport them.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they might very well come back. I get that. But that would be true regardless.
Yeah.
So we've got big problems there.
Yeah.
But Texas, at the very least, is doing its part. And I joke around, like as soon as Texas was affirmed to be able to enforce its own borders, I said, and just like that, migrants didn't cross the border with Texas anymore.
Okay.
They went instead to New Mexico, Arizona, and California.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And that'll cause more pressure upon those states. You'll see. It's just, it angers me so much because it's so transparent. And when Biden says, I don't know what to do. I can't control anything. I mean, I'm just the president here.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you're the president and you have all the power.
That's
like one thing you can do
is
to enforce the border with any sort of executive orders.
Yeah.
Just do it. But you dismantled everything Trump had done, which was pretty, very largely effective. Now you do this. And now you actually say that you should allow federal agents to cut the barbed wire.
Right.
That Texas put up. Thankfully, the federal border agents say, no, we're not going to do that. And Texas is basically saying, okay, you can cut as much as you like. There's, first of all, there's a lot of barbed wire. Yeah. And to whatever extent you do cut the barbed wire, we're going to be putting up more barbed wire to replace it. Right. So you can come back every day.
Yeah.
No problem. It's like graffiti. You know, like somebody puts graffiti on it, you paint over it. You put the graffiti back and so on. It'll just be that, that kind of game.
Yeah.
But they won't be able to. The border agents are not excited about cutting the border fence. I mean, they, largely they're there because they want to actually protect the border.
Right.
So it, I would be very, oh, yeah, let me come out with my border cut, my wire cutters. Oh, look, I seem to be missing the cut. Oh, it's just so dark here. But what do you mean, sir? It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Oh, I can't see. I got to get LASIK surgery. I keep on missing these wires.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, how can Mayorkas expect somebody to actually do their job when he is not himself doing his job? His job is to secure the border. He's not doing it. So if the border guards don't follow his orders, well, guess what?
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. All right, folks. Well, listen, I want to play this fantastic interview with Moti Guor, who was an incredible man that is on the board with me, on Stand With Us, has incredible military experience as well. So without further ado, Moti Guor. All right, we are very lucky to have a special guest with us today in the Barack Larry podcast. Moti Guor, who is a friend of mine. We have a lot in common. We're both Israeli, although Moti has been around in Israel a little bit more. He also participated in and fought in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, which a lot of you already know about. Moti is also a former vice president with Stand With Us, which is a very pro-Israel group fighting anti-Semitism on campuses and elsewhere. He was also a co-founder of that along with Roz Rothstein and Jerry Rothstein and Esther Renzer. Fantastic group. I'm on the board as well. I'm very proud of that. We're just delighted to have you here, and thanks so much for joining us. We wanted to talk to you, Moti, because you have some inside knowledge with your experience, having fought in many battles for Israel against mostly Arab armies, the mentality of what Israel is dealing with. Now in Gaza, and generally speaking, in all the fights. I have also had the advantage, my father fought in three of the Israeli wars, including the Yom Kippur War, and he will tell similar stories. He's passed on in the meantime, so we don't have the benefit of his great testimony. But man, oh man, it's fascinating, and this is going to be an eye-opener, guys. To listen to Moti Guor. Anyway, Moti, welcome to the Barack Larry podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Yeah. I appreciate that.
You bet. So tell us a little bit about, you know, some of your experience, some of your stories that you learned about the nature of fighting against the Arabs, some of the things that you had seen in terms of their tactics.
I'm going to tell you some, one of the stories that really shook me. That was May 1970, May 21st, 1970. It was 2 days after my 20th birthday. We were patrolling the Lebanese border, and there is villages along the border where, you know, they are farming villages. Not every village have schools, so the bus in the morning come up and drive to the center of the village, picking up kids, and then goes to the next village where there is a school over there. So there is the parents putting the kids on the bus and say goodbye and everything. The bus go right on the main road over there and just turn into the main road. And some Arabs from Lebanon staying up on top of the hill over there and shooting a bazooka into the school bus and killing instantly 9 of the children, another 3 adult, and 25 injured over there, right there. And the parents was just put the children on the bus. They were like running crazy, to see their children over there in a bus and all that things. And my thinking was that we were not that far away patrolling the border. And, hey, if you want to come and kill me, go ahead. I'm a soldier.
Yeah.
You know, you can...
Play fair. I mean, let's fight soldier to soldier.
Exactly. And why are you shooting? Why are you going after children and civilians? But as that was really kind of set me up, what is the Arabs all about and what the value that they have and what they are going after. And this is happening many, many times after that I pay more and more attention and drove me to learn more about Islam history and what went on from the beginning, from Muhammad time, you know, in the Arabia, where they came up as a society that lives over there in the desert, a tribal society. It's a culture that the law of the desert is, if you are strong, you are the law. You can go to the next village, you can kill, you can rape, you can steal, you can do whatever you want. Who's going to judge you? Who's going to stop you? Who's going to do anything? Nobody, because you're the strong. So that the culture that the Islam grew up with, and very, very, that culture sink into the Quran. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to repeat now.
You're talking about that mentality that you're dealing with. And look, I mean, what you're saying about deception, a lot of it is deception. And deception is often a tool of war. I get that. You know, I mean, Americans use deception to fool the Germans into thinking that the D-Day was going to happen in Calais in France instead of D-Day where it did happen in Normandy. Yeah. But that's one kind of deception. Another kind of deception is where people pretend to be surrendering. And Americans know a little bit about this in the first Gulf War in 1991, I believe, where Iraqi soldiers came out with white flags saying that they were surrendering. And when the Americans dropped their weapons to collect the would-be prisoners, then they take a shot. Then they start shooting at them. And the Americans were shocked about this, understandably. But it was one of the first tastes that Americans had to deal with this kind of mentality. You also spoke about some tactics that we see with the pregnant women. Why don't you explore a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, right there in 1948, when the Israeli military had to go into a house where they were shooting at them, and then they wanted to find out who's shooting at them, and then they go inside the house, and this pregnant woman, she's raising her hand up in the air and everything. So the Israeli soldiers automatically lower the weapons and everything looks okay. And then when they lower the weapons, her husband jumped from the back of the sofa or something, wherever they were, and shoot the soldiers. So Israel learned on the hard way, you know, to not trust the Arabs. They are so, deceptive. And it cost a lot of blood, a lot of life, because the trust was not there at all. And even today, there is no trust at all. They are like telling one thing or do something, and it's not a trust.
Right. And trust is an important issue, of course, but there's also rules of engagement, right, where you must wear a soldier's uniform. Even if it might be, you know, ragtag stuff, you still have to wear some clothing that identifies you as a soldier of this or that country, or in the case of Hamas, this or that organization. Fine, so do that. But what's happening in Gaza right now, consistent with what you just said, Moti, is that they've developed a system in Gaza where they hide a whole bunch of guns throughout the entire area of Gaza, and they dress in civilian clothing and then when they're called upon, whatever it is, that they can race to the particular apartment where they know there are some guns hiding there for them, and they whip it out and they start fighting as militants. So they get to pretend that they're not militants, and while they don't have their guns, and then be soldiers, quote unquote, when they do have their guns. It's a very weird dynamic, and it's very difficult for the Israelis. One thing I'm very interested in, and understanding from you, Moti, is, and Devin, if you have any questions, because it's fascinating, this area. This is really a unique opportunity. Yeah. You saw the Chuck Schumer speech in the Senate, right? It was.
I'm shocked.
So,
I'm
totally shocked.
So shocked and disappointed. I'm like, unbelievable that they. A leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate over there, and going to another Democratic Party, an ally of Israel, of United States, and he goes and tell them, you need another election. We just had an election, and you can throw away the prime minister, and he's telling them, oh, this is not a democracy, which. What do you mean? We just had a free election. We have people spoke up.
I think there was four elections in the span of 18 months or something.
Right.
It was a very short window, whatever it was, with 2 or 3 years. But four elections. I think we have plenty of elections, Mr. Schumer. Okay, that's enough with the elections. Yeah. And they voted time and time again. So what's your vision, Chuck Schumer, that we have another election and they vote for Netanyahu again? I mean, and then he says, well, until this war dies down. Okay, well, then just wait till this war dies down then. It's a very weird dynamic. Look, let's not pretend that the reason why they're doing this is anything other than to somehow appeal to the Muslim vote, mostly in Michigan, but elsewhere as well, because they know they've got a big problem here. And, you know, many of my Democrat friends say, oh, it's so ironic, you know, it's so difficult, you know, you're going to get votes, Barack, your team, meaning the Republican team, because of this anti-Israel vote is not going to be voting for Biden. And doesn't that say something good about Biden? And I say, no, first of all, you made strange bedfellows with these terrorists, okay? I'm not saying the Muslims in Michigan are all terrorists, but you've made it so that you have to appease terrorists in the Middle East to get votes in Michigan and elsewhere. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that it's not a good thing that you expect this. I mean, you have to. We're not impressed with this. The fact that you are so busy trying to collect votes from every group that you can. And that means that you're not doing the right thing with a capital R. You have to fight for Israel, regardless of the consequences, right? So the Republican Party supports Israel. That's part of the reason, one of the many reasons, I joined the Republican Party, switched from Democrat to Republican more than 20 years ago now. And I'm very proud of that. But you don't just start agreeing with whatever anybody says, because you want to get votes. There's a famous Saturday Night Live skit, and they had the guy pretending to be Bill Clinton, and he I don't know if you know this, but it's a skit where he said he was agreeable to everything, you know, and people would say, well, what about this? He goes, there's nothing more important than that, you know, and he would describe it, and then somebody from the opposite side would talk about, what about this? Wouldn't you agree? There's nothing more important than that. You know, it's like he would suck and blow and talk out of both sides of his mouth time and time again. It was very funny. But that's the way I feel about the Democrat Party today, that they will just do anything to get any kind of vote. And maybe you should just say, you know what? We're not on the side of terrorism. We're on the side of Israel. She's the good guy country here, and that's the way it is. And you don't have to like it. I don't care. But we stand for virtue and morality and truth and for God, for that matter. And we're okay with that as part of the Republican Party. And guess what? Because of that, the Republican Party now can claim more than a majority of the Latino vote for the first time in I don't know how many decades. They can claim 23% of the black vote, which is almost three times two and a half times the amount that they need to win an election, which is 9%, historically at least. Which is a look. I mean, 23% is a lot less than what you want. Of course, you want it to be 50% or 60% or 70%. I get it, but historically, that's fantastic. Even the Jewish vote is now something like 30% voting for the Republicans, where historically it was more 20%. So I'm very pleased about the shifting things. But that's because the Republicans stand on the side of morality, not the side of just getting whatever votes you can and saying whatever you need to say. So Chuck Schumer, very disappointing, as you said. And I want to also get your take on the future of Israel. Here's what I've noticed. You tell me if I'm wrong, okay? Historically, Israel was, in the beginning, it actually was a very liberal country, meaning, you know, a progressive left-wing country. Ben-Gurion was part of the Labor Party, which was their version of the Democrat Party. So was Eshkol, so was, what's her name? Golda Meir, and so on. And that was true. It was like, it was a given that the prime minister was going to be from the Labor Party. Likud was a small party back then. It had some force, but it was a small party. But it grew and grew to the point that in 1979, I believe it was, this man named Menachem Begin became the prime minister from Likud,
yes,
their version of the Republican Party. And he was a great leader.
Great leader.
Right?
And great person.
Yeah. And a great person all the way around.
When I was in the military at one point, we came to visit. They took us on a tour to the Knesset.
Yeah.
And he is the first to come to our bus and came and gave each of us a hug and says, well, you know, like in Hebrew, you know, like that, welcome my son, you know, like that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, he was a good man. And he was remarkable. I mean, the things that he achieved. Anyway, so, but then from 1980... to 2000, the Likud and Labor Party jockeyed for power, back and forth, right?
Yeah.
And there was Rabin and Perez, of course, and then you had others who were Likud.
What made the turnaround was Oslo Peace Accord, which in 1993, where Rabin and Perez agree to give to the Palestinians some guns so they can control the terrorism and what's happened. And they really turned the gun into Israel. And if you look at the number of terror that they did to Israel after 1993, where every other day there is a bus blowing up, a restaurant blowing up.
You're so right. And it was. I remember that time. I happened to be in Israel when the Oslo Accords were announced.
Yes. And there was that was when people really realized that they're dealing with animals. They are dealing with people that they are willing to give up their life. And I'll tell you a short story. In 1974, I flew to Israel. At that time, the TWA, I think it was, they landing in Israel. You arrive to Israel about 5 in the morning. And then I go over there to the rent-a-car, tried to pick it up, and they said, you know, we don't have your car here. You have to go to Dizengoff and be there at 9.
Dizengoff is a major shopping center in Tel Aviv.
Yeah. So I took a bus and dropped my suitcase in Kfar Saba, and then I took the next bus to Dizengoff. And I got off the bus at 9 o'clock, and I wanted to have a coffee, and then I said, no, it's 9 o'clock. They told me to be there at 9. I have like a 5 minutes walk. I'm going to start walking. 9:04, I was like 2 blocks away. 9:04, the next bus came and blew up exactly where I a huge explosion. And later on, I read that the explosion was so hard, it lifted up the chassis of the bus 7 feet in the air. It was pieces of people all over. And then, this is what's even more important. In the evening, I was in Kfar Saba, which is 1 kilometer from Kalkilia. And found out that the guy that did it came from an affluent family in Kalkilia and all that things, and he were willing to kill himself. But they celebrated 3 days. They celebrate day and night, all night long. They celebrate that now he's a shahid, which it means like he's a martyr, and now he's in heaven, and he did such a great thing. The next day, the city, the school's kids came over in front of the house of that guy, and the parents were sitting outside, and they were like coming and shaking their hands, and all the politicians coming, and they were like, had a huge celebration over there in Qalqilya for what this guy did.
Yeah.
And then you think about, this guy was a terrorist. He killed people. He killed innocent people that going 9 o'clock, going over there shopping and going to work and going all kind of things, and mothers and like that. And he killed, and they didn't care. They were celebrating it. And this is the mentality that Israel have to deal with. And,
It is fascinating. I do remember those times. And I kept on saying, look, there's been far more terrorism since the Oslo Accords, which was never finalized, thankfully, than ever before. And you can't say that these were good things. But I want to put a pin on that for a second, because I think that is a major factor in the change in dynamics. But I was saying that the political parties were back and forth between 1980 and the year 2000, more or less.
Yeah.
And then starting in 2000, it started being Likud all the time.
Yes.
By the year 2003 or so, the Labor Party, their version of the Democrat Party, became a nullity. It became irrelevant.
Right.
It is now the size of the Green Party in America.
Right.
It's just, they will never win again. And it's what's fascinating about this is the why. I think that the Oslo Peace Accord was definitely a very big factor, a sense that we really have to be stronger to fight against the Palestinians, because they are, in fact, really just trying to take over all of Israel. They'll never be happy. You give them what they want, and they'll want more. They'll pretend that you didn't give them anything that they wanted, and that we're still somehow occupying their land. Which, of course, is not true. We don't need to get into the history of that. We've talked about this quite extensively before. Now, what's interesting is that it's only going to be conservative. It's all the prime ministers are different degrees of conservative, right? Very strong. And it's starting off with Arik Sharon, who was such a fantastic prime minister. I do demur to... I was very upset when he left Gaza in 2005.
Disengagement.
This was a terrible decision. Yeah.
We're paying for it.
We're paying for it now. We've had four major wars, this one being much bigger, of course, since the pullout from Gaza in 2005. Yes, it was expensive to protect Gaza, to make sure that we were safe from Gaza, but it's a hell of a lot more expensive now, both in terms of money and lives lost. And hostages taken and everything else than it ever was. And they still use the same language. Occupiers, we just pulled out. Well, there's nobody occupying your so-called land. Anyway, bottom line is that it's much more conservative now. Now, I think part of the reason why, and a major part of the reason why, is that the religious folk in Israel have a lot of babies.
Yes.
Tons and tons of babies. And I like that. I like it a lot. They have on average between 5 and 12 children per...
I think it's 8.6.
So right in the middle, right? 8.6. And then these kids grow up and they vote.
Yeah.
And they vote conservative.
Yeah.
They don't like the Labor Party. And that's why they're a nullity anymore. In addition to Oslo. I think they showed themselves to be a disaster. But anyway, here we are. Israel is now a very strong country. It's a very capitalist country now, which is wonderful to see. You know about all the high tech stuff that's going on. I'm very proud of Israel. I'm proud to be Israeli. I know you are proud to be Israeli as well. And it is a beacon of light to the whole world, as it should be, for anybody who actually looks into Israel. If they actually decide, I want to figure this out. I really want to understand it. As soon as they ask themselves that question, they become pro-Israel. That's the bottom line, right?
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me, Devin, and Moti, is that, you know, today, let's put it back in the year 1700, for example, right? if you were to talk here in America, if you were to talk about a faraway country like China, okay, you would only and ask to be have the impression what your impression of China is. It'd be based on no pictures because there were no cameras back then. You would hear stories from somebody who may have been in China, more likely somebody who heard from that person who went to China. And then you have this impression, okay, well, they have their eyes are shaped differently. They wear these big coned hats, and some of them wear mustaches in a certain way, and they wear these big flowy outfits.
Yes.
Okay, that's all you would know. And flip-flops. Yeah. That's it. And their writing is kind of like a hodgepodge of crazy things.
Yeah.
That's what you would know, and nothing more. Anyway, so I find that very fascinating, right? But that's not the way it is today.
No.
Today, if you want to get information, you go on Google, and you get a tremendous amount of information.
Right.
And you can find out anything you want, right?
Yeah.
And so this younger group, you know, I don't know, 40 years old and younger, they can have all this access that they want. But they Google everything except for Israel. With Israel,
yeah.
They just get told what to think
yeah.
from their professors or whatever, using words like apartheid and genocide and racism and colonialist, you know, enterprise and occupiers.
Yeah.
That's all they hear. And they take it to the bank.
Yeah.
That's it. They don't Google anything. That's why I say, were they to simply look through Google, they'd get their answers, right? Fascinating.
And we just, the last 6 months or so, we saw student with political science from Harvard that coming up and protesting from the river to the sea. And there's a guy, there's all kind of guys that go and interview them and says, what river?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and I'm not sure if it's a river or a mountain, but you know, it's to the sea. I know maybe this is the Black Sea. No, it's the Red Sea. And they have no clue about nothing, and it's become a joke. And I'm thinking their parents spending thousands of dollars to send
tens of thousands, yeah.
To Harvard and to other, high-ranking universities, and that kid makes such a stupid about himself, about the university, about everything, and that's because we have very liberal professors over there that brainwashing them and even incitement against Israel.
For sure. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is, and my attack on these idiots is to really expose them just by asking questions.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, how can you say that Israel is the only democracy? And do you know that? I just ask them questions. I ask them, like, where is Israel on the map? Right? Where? They don't know. What's the population ratio between Israelis on the one hand and the Arab population that is enemies with Israel on the other hand? Wait, tell me the ratio. They don't know. What is the size of Israel compared to a state or maybe a combination of states from America? They have no clue. They think it's the size of Texas, by the way.
Right.
They always say Texas because they're guessing. But as far as they know, they wouldn't be surprised. If you told them that Israel is the size of half of Canada, and it was, in fact, in Canada right now, they would say, oh, cool. All right. Understood.
Well,
they would do that.
Yeah.
That's what you're really dealing with. And you have to just expose them for their nonsense.
Sometimes when I'm speaking and I'm telling them that Israel is going feeding inside San Bernardino County twice. And they have, what? And I says, yeah, Israel fitting into San Bernardino twice, county twice. They are so tiny, they're smaller than New Jersey. Yeah. And around them, surrounded with 21 Arab countries that 800 times bigger, that they are praying and worshiping ideology to destroy Israel. And Israel have to deal with that. And Israel has been there, you know, for thousands of years before it was Islam.
Yeah, of course. And then you, one of my many questions is how big is the Muslim population in the world, and how big is the entire Jewish population? Not just Israeli, but Jewish.
Yeah.
And, you know, the answer is 1.5 billion Muslims.
Yeah.
And 14 million,
yes.
million, that's with an M,
yes.
Jews, right? So that's what we're dealing with. And I think there's a survey that shows that they did a survey of Muslims throughout the world, and some staggering percentage, some ridiculous percentage, want to actually fight and, you know, and commit terrorism against Israel, yeah. and Jews. It's something like 20%, and maybe higher.
Yeah.
And then of the rest of them, they either want to help them financially or otherwise support them emotionally, right? And only like 10% are against it, against terrorism.
Yeah. We just had a few polls over there in Gaza and in the Judea and Samaria, and the Arabs over there, 87% of them are supporting the Hamas of what they did. It's just unbelievable that they, you know, I mean, all that massacres and killing and raping and hostages and all that, they support that. They think it's good, it's great. And we've got videos over there how they are cheering the Hamas and all that things. I want to say something that what you just said a minute ago. Israel is, the Jewish people, they are 0.02 of the world right now. We are small. However, we are 26% of Nobel Prize. Our invention, our contribution to the medical, to the medical, to the technology, to agriculture, to environment, to many, many things, to the world. And people using, everybody using our, you know, our invention, yet some of them don't even know about it. In fact,
they don't know about it. And to the extent that they do know about it, I think subconsciously they do know about it. They will say in response that they resent it. They are, because along with that, Moti, comes the sense of, you know, following the Torah, following the Ten Commandments, this sense of accountability. They would rather live in a world that's primitive, without the medical stuff, without the technology that you're talking about, without the other, all the other advances that Israel has given and Jews have given to the world, they would rather not live with that so long as they can live without accountability.
Right.
That is the Faustian bargain that they would be happy to take. That's my personal opinion. Listen, I have one more question for you before we wrap this up. And thank you so much for being here on the Barak Leonard podcast. What's going to happen? What is your, from a military strategy point of view? I know you know a lot about this.
Yeah.
You're in the army. Right now, as we speak, Israel has surrounded Rafah, which is the southernmost town in what is called the Gaza Strip. It's right alongside the border with Egypt. That the goal is to squeeze Rafah so much that we rout out all the Hamas operatives and either kill them or take them as prisoners. And hopefully also get back some of the hostages, God willing. What happens, you know, first of all, do you like that strategy? I personally do. I think it's the right way. They've basically taken all of Gaza now for the time being. I think it's nonsense for Biden to suggest that somehow they can't take Rafah. That's ridiculous. Forget about America. Forget about Biden because he's an idiot.
Yeah.
But once they do that, and God willing, like I said, this is the last stand for Hamas. Get rid of Hamas. What happens then? What's the best plan for Israel?
The best plan for Israel is to keep control of Gaza,
yeah.
And they will take Rafah, and they will because Rafah is a major way of letting all kind of supply, military, and all kind of things for the Hamas. So Israel have to have control of it, and of course getting the hostages back, but keeping Gaza under control, full control, military control, let them manage their own life. But Israel has to have the military over there and make sure that they're not teaching their children to kill us. They're not teaching. They're not building up this kind of hate anywhere. Not incitement, not the brainwashing, and all that things. And just have no choice but keeping Gaza under control, just like the Judea and Samaria under Jewish control.
Yeah.
And that you cannot trust them. you know, I know there is a lot of lefties in Israel, and they think there is coexistence, and we can coexist. But it's proven one time after time, yeah. time and again, that the Arabs, all what they want, all their focus, they have a new baby. And before the baby knows anything, they start teaching about killing the Jews, you know?
In the womb, they might whisper, you know, like, you know how a woman rubs her belly, yeah. you know, as you, and she'll say, we're going to, I just know he'll be great. He'll be a great shaheed, and he'll kill many Israelis before he kills himself.
Yes.
You know, like in a sweet. It's so cynical. It's so horrific.
Yeah.
Look, my personal opinion about this is I think we take a page out of the American playbook after World War II. I think we prosecuted that war beautifully. I mean, I wish we'd never gone into the war. We'd never had to go into the war in the first place, but it was what it was. And once the war started, I think we executed and prosecuted it very well, especially toward the end. Why do I say that? It's because after World War II and the Germans surrendered and the Japanese surrendered, the Americans did the same thing in both countries. They kept soldiers in those countries, yeah. and they denazified the Germany, and they de-imperialized Japan and basically forced a democratic system on both countries. And both those countries are now remarkably successful, and they're great allies
yes.
of America now.
Yeah.
They're among the very best of allies. And I think we need to do the same thing. I think Israel needs to, yes, occupy all of Gaza, even though it's not Palestine. You know, it's not even a good example because Germany was still a sovereign country.
Yeah.
Japan was a sovereign country. Gaza is not even a sovereign country. So just take it. For the time being, for a good 10 years.
At least.
Until you can totally change the education system
yeah.
of Gaza, completely change the political system of Gaza, and make them, God willing, you know, a great trading partner, maybe even a great partner in peace in every way. Make them like the UAE or,
yeah.
you know, Dubai
yeah.
or Singapore. I mean, Singapore is not a Muslim country, but you get the idea. So I think that's the only way we really achieve peace, at least with vis-a-vis Gaza.
They start talking about, and this is what, and to divide, not really divide Gaza into chamulas, you know, like that. They're really
What is a chamula? What is that?
A tribal thing,
oh, okay.
you know, like that. It's like the family. So they have different family that they control. They have the head of that family.
Mm.
It's very tribal in mentality.
So that complicates things.
So to let... or emirate, you know, like the emirate. It's to put a few emirate. Each family over there control their area and control their people. And Israel control the whole thing just to make sure that the military and this control the area and make sure that it's run like a democracy, like a real democracy.
Yeah. It's the only way. It's really the only way. I mean, we can play this game. It's never worked before to try to make peace with the dictatorship. The most you can achieve with the dictatorship is a détente, a sort of an agreement not to kill each other for the time being. That's not a healthy approach. And certainly with the Palestinians in Gaza, we've seen that is just not working. This is too many decades now. We are foolish to think that we can have a peace agreement with dictators when they are telling their people to kill as many Israelis as they can, when they're building their entire infrastructure solely to destroy their enemy, in this case, Israel. All right, Moti Guor, thank you so much for being on the Barak Lehrer podcast. It was really a joy having you. And thank you for all your efforts with Stand With Us and speaking your mind about Israel and being a fighter for Israel. It means a lot to me.
Thanks a million. Thank you for what you do too. Then you're on the board with me, so we're going to push.
Brothers in arms we are.
Yes.
All right, God bless, Moti. All the best.
Thank you.
Anyway, folks, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for listening to the Barak Lehrer podcast today. Don't forget to get our book, Keeping the Kids All Right, How to Keep Your Kids Away from the Woke Culture. They'll never be indoctrinated. It's awesome. They'll always be conservative, and they'll always be your best friend. Barak Lehrer signing off, saying God bless. And we'll talk with you next week.